It's now Monday, May 8th, and we're here again with Fletcher Prouty today to discuss aspects of the Kennedy assassination on November 22nd, 1963, and some of the ramifications of the types of power groups or power group base that seems to somehow have its hand in all this from trying to examine the details of this massive area of information about a very seminal event for post-World War II directions in United States policies and agendas, at least in the political realm. I'd like to start with a pretty open-ended question, positing, knowing what you know now, if you were put in the position of being in charge of investigating Kennedy's assassination the day after he was murdered, when almost everyone was still alive, and you had subpoena power, etc., what witnesses would you call and what leads would you pursue?
Well, that certainly is a fundamental question. Of course, we all realize that murder in the United States, by law, by tradition, is the function of state governments. What should have been done immediately was to have the state of Texas begin to solve that murder without any delay. The body of President Kennedy should not have been moved from Texas. The autopsy should have been completed by the same people that were there when he was brought into the hospital. The police should have been the same police that were on duty when the president was moving through town. And the very next day, those policemen, all of them, should have been convened in a meeting so that everything they knew would be put down and recorded immediately, including the long conversations that had been had with Lee Harvey Oswald the night that he was picked up, because I think most of us will recall that he was not picked up on the charge of having shot the president. He was picked up on a collateral charge of having something to do with the death of a policeman named Tippit. And it's rather interesting to note that some newspapers printed that Officer Tippit had been sent to arrest Oswald, and that was immediate printing. That was before the cover story came in. Later papers went along the cover story that Oswald, for some reason, got an argument with Tippit and shot him. Not anything to do with the original reports of the time. So first of all, if any of us were on the spot and charged with solving that murder, we'd have done the same thing you do with any murder. We'd have policemen and detectives on the spot and immediately begin to ask the questions that would solve this murder, which was clearly the activity of several people, highly trained, and with a lot of other people in the area taking part in this, in the business of this whole assassination. Well, if the work had been done that way, the possibility is that there would have been no mystery from the time of the autopsy right in the Parkland Hospital, because it was clear that the president had been hit in the back. That's a wound from the back. That he had been hit in the throat, a wound from the front. That he had been hit in the forehead, that's a wound from the side front. That the back of his head had been completely blown off, that's from a bullet going through his head and blowing off the back of his head. That there was a bullet that hit a man named Taig, who was a block and a half down the street. In other words, a low trajectory bullet, not one from the sixth floor going down to hit the pavement. This one went a block and a half and hit the curb through a fragment of the bullet or curb up, and that hit Mr. Taig in the face, and photographers took pictures of him with blood running down his face. That's another bullet. So there's four bullets right there. That disproves the entire Warren Commission report. But police would have handled that immediately. They would have gone to the places where those bullets originated from and begin to solve the crime the same as any other crime. There are reports of them locating a British 303 rifle, of a German Mauser rifle, and of this Italian Carcano rifle from the same period of time, within hours. Any police department would have resolved that immediately by finding the rifle that had been fired, by matching it to the bullets, and discarding the other bullet. If the normal police activity that takes place in any small town in the country had been put into motion within moments of that crime, it would have been solved before midnight. And if we remember, Oswald was not even charged with the death of Kennedy until after midnight. So even that aspect of it is illusory. And then they interviewed Oswald all during that night and claimed that they never took any notes at all. That's fabulous. They couldn't have done that in a police service unless the policemen were part of the, and you'd find that. Then you say to the police, you're part of the conspiracy, because why didn't you take notes? You see, could have stopped that thing immediately.
Yeah.
And with the body there to match it to all this evidence, there would have been none of these things about all the bullets from a single man up until now. As soon as you throw out, and it has taken the press in this world 25 years to throw out the idea that Oswald was the lone assassin. The House Committee study in the late 70s came up with the idea that they are convinced because they found more bullet, the more rifle firing sounds on the sound tapes than three, that they think there was a conspiracy. The newspapers haven't even picked it up. If you read a newspaper today, whether printed in San Francisco or Singapore, it says President Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. That is evidence of one of the most powerful cover-up situations ever created. That for 25 years, they can force the media of the world to speak like parrots with respect to the death of Kennedy, that he was killed by a lone assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald. They will not print anything else. Although 99% of the people of this world believe that the president was killed otherwise. It's a fascinating thing to think about how solid and how powerful this cover-up arrangement is. Then when you begin to add to that the fact that the plan to kill a president can only mean one thing, that the people who made that plan intended to take over control of the United States of America. Then you begin to see that they have the power to kill the president and to create the cover-up and, of course, to take over the presidency for the objectives that they had. Those things begin to clarify who did it, how they did it, why they did it. That's what you do with any crime. So if I had been in charge of the investigation of the president's death in Dallas for the next 24 hours afterwards, I think within 6 or 8 hours we'd have solved the crime. There would have been none of this lone assassin business. Now, the important thing about having people realize that there was not a lone assassin is the next step. That if there was a group and if they conspired to kill the president, then they had an objective. A lone assassin doesn't have to have an objective. He can be a nut. Somebody just fired the gun and he's a nut. And that's what they try to make us believe. But the minute you say there were people who planned to kill the president, whether it was Castro and his people, whether it was Khrushchev and his people, whether it was the mafia and their people, or some other hate group, they had an objective. And at least we are maturing in our thinking about Kennedy's death. By now we can say the mafia did it, or Castro did, at least we are pointing the finger to groups that have an objective. And I think within the next 3 or 4 years, they will finally begin to come around to what this objective was. And we may become mature enough in this country by 30 years after Kennedy's death to begin to lay down exactly what happened at the time he was killed, that an extremely powerful group within the United States government set up the objective of killing Kennedy in order to control the progress of the government in the direction they wanted for the next 8, 10, 12 years. There's no question about it looking back.
And in that current scenario, there's various groups that have at times been, there's been some stories put out positing Castro wanted to kill him or the mob, which all to me seem derelict in the ability, which was not Castro or Khrushchev or the mob's capabilities, of engineering things like getting the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to head up a commission to cover it up, or the Dallas Police Department or whoever else, the authorities either locally or federally, who had some key roles here or there in at least the post-assassination alteration of stories to conform to a lone nut.
Well, you see, that's what I'm saying. When we finally mature ourselves enough to realize that the president was not killed by a lone assassin who had no real motive, he just did it, the minute we move ourselves into saying that some organization did it, whether it's Castro, Khrushchev, Mafia, whatever, immediately we are saying there was a motive for doing this. Now the motive then is one of a group that, and their objective, of course, was the control of the government of the United States. Now as soon as we think that a group did this, the next thing is to think of the environment in which it happened. A lot of things were happening in the 90 days before the president was killed. He had made a speech at the UN saying that he was not going to have NASA arrange the shot to the moon by itself, but he was going to merge our space agency in with the Russian space agency in a cooperative attempt to go to the moon. He thought that would be internationally palatable. It would help ease the pressures of the Cold War and would really make progress for the world as well as putting a man on the moon. Well, now, of course, that upset the tens of thousands of people who work for NASA and their supporters throughout the industry and a lot of other people who were just believe in anti-communism and the Cold War anyway. But Kennedy had done that within 90 days before his death. Another thing that a lot of other people have not noticed because it's a little more intricate is that at the time Kennedy became president, one of the biggest aircraft procurement projects ever designed was on the boards. The Eisenhower administration had not settled it, and they handed it over to the Kennedy administration, assuming, of course, that they thought Nixon was going to be elected and he would solve the problem. It was called the TFX fighter program. With that much money, upwards of $6 to $7 billion, I believe, which in those days was an enormous amount of money, there was an awful lot of pressure on a selection of this TFX fighter. And it was it finally came down to a consortium with the General Dynamics Company of California versus the proposals from the Boeing Company. And in this work, the Kennedy administration changed drastically the method of weapons procurement that had existed since World War II. And one of the active parts in this was the role of Arthur Goldberg, the Secretary of Labor, who, very politically astute gentleman, saw that the Kennedy election over Nixon was a very, very narrow margin. So that what Goldberg proposed was that if the companies bidding for the aircraft own properties and factories in areas where Kennedy needed the vote, then the one with the most factories in the most areas should be given the contract, simply so that that money would flow in areas that would be politically expedient to Kennedy's re-election in 1963. Well, this was, a lot of people didn't see that working, but within the Pentagon, for example, they set up a series of offices, posted on the walls county divided maps of the whole United States, county by county, state by state. And they would draw the colored markers on there. Every General Dynamics proposal, they'd set the colors up for the counties the General Dynamics covered. And the Boeing proposal, likewise. So that by the time they got to make the decision on the aircraft, they decided to purchase the General Dynamics plane versus, you might say, the more popular, at least within the military industry complex, Boeing suggestion. And the final McNamara decision to give that contract to General Dynamics staggered the industry. And it's a very powerful industry to have opposition. In addition to that, Mr. McNamara's Deputy Secretary of Defense, Roswell Gilpatrick, was traveling around the country speaking at bankers' conventions and other important meetings, saying that from now on the Kennedy administration was going to see that procurement money was more wisely used and that the old power groups of the Eisenhower days were ended. And although that was a rather quiet thing with respect to news, it was a most important area of opposition to the Kennedy administration. It was a very important area. So there's a second one added up. In the Vietnam War, which was growing, and you know, in 1962, 1963, the Vietnam War was not a big issue. It was a small thing. The trouble in Laos was more important. The trouble in the Congo was more important. It wasn't the whole thing. We did more in anti-Castro work, you might say, than we did in Vietnam. So that it's by looking back at it that we think the Vietnam War in 63 was a major issue. So by the summer of 63, Kennedy had properly analyzed that if the people of South Vietnam wanted to set up their own country and run their own country, they were going to have to fight for their own country, the same as our people did in the Revolutionary War against the British. It was the Americans that fought the British and did it themselves. And he thought that Vietnamization was the way to do it. We would provide the support and we would help them. With that on his mind, he set up the procedures to produce what became NSAM 263, where he announced to the public that with before the end of the year, he would bring 1,000 troops home for Christmas. And by the end of 1965, he would bring the bulk of American personnel home. And personnel being a comprehensive term, not just military, but all the personnel in Vietnam. It just happens that I worked on that paper with General Krulak and his staff, and I have no question about the significance of the words in that paper, because we were instructed by the White House to see that this was clear, that 1,000 men would be home by the end of 63, and the bulk of American personnel by the end of 65. Kennedy was removing us from Vietnam. And that hit like a bolt of lightning. So there were those pressures. There were pressures in the education system, and there was sufficient pressure to see that certain groups would like to remove Kennedy, because by the end of 63, it was becoming clear that he would win the next election and have another 4 years in office, that Bobby was right behind him, that Teddy was right behind Bobby, and on. There was a Kennedy regime being set up. I think that pressure is what caused his death, because it is that kind of pressure that could very easily weld itself together into an assassination program, where the assassination was be laid on in a professional manner, as they are done in coup d'etats around the world, where the hitmen are professionals, they are covered by the local police and removed from the scene, and they're gone, and then nobody knows who did it, and they never find out about it. That's the way Kennedy was killed, and those are the reasons for which he was killed.
In looking back at the actual execution of the murder, the planning and execution, what role, if any, do you feel the following government agencies or individuals within those agencies played? I want to just run down a list here. Start with the FBI.
Well, I'll just say first that no agency played a role as an agency. What happens in such things as this? In fact, we had a term for it. We called it the Gold Key Club. A certain small group coalesces, and they are given an order to do something, and it's not by agency. As a comparison, there was a program that had been constituted, I think, in 62, called Mongoose. And the objective of Mongoose was to remove Castro from office in Cuba. Well, the people that were assigned to Mongoose under the direction of General Lansdale were from various agencies working together, and some who were not from any agencies. They were hired employees from other specialties and other businesses that are competent in this business of establishing coup d'etats and things like that. So it's not correct to say that the FBI, the CIA, the Department of Defense, State Department had a role in this. It could very well be, and I'm quite sure it was, that people from those agencies might have been called upon for certain specialties, mm-hmm. but that isn't how these jobs are done.
So there wouldn't be much point in looking, going through, as far as being able to have anyone that you felt somehow, oh yeah, well that person must have had this to do with it or that to do with it.
Not that specifically. Those things are done. I worked on assassinations in other countries or the removal of office from people from other countries. And it was not done agency by agency. It was done on the basis of a very cleverly arranged group arrangement, which would get the job done.
Okay.
By people who are very proficient in that type of business.
I would like to look at a few instances, though, of just examining what evidence did go down, particularly in terms of something like the Secret Service. Now, you served in some function in Eisenhower's term as something to do with helping with security for the president with the Secret Service?
Okay, that's an interesting point. The Secret Service is well-trained, and it has manuals that direct how they operate for what is called protection of the president. It's a small organization, and what they do in general practice is augment the Secret Service when necessary with specially trained units from the US military. And the thing that we notice in the assassination of President Kennedy was that certain of these Secret Service units and military units that should have been along the streets in Dallas, that should have closed windows in Dallas, that should have welded manhole covers in the streets, and should have done all of the things, should have designed a route through the city that was safe. For instance, they have a rule that says if your automobile with the president cannot travel 44 miles an hour, you have to go on another route. I argued with them one day, just kind of jokingly, why 44? Why not 45? Why not 4? And they said, we have learned that at 44 miles an hour, a gunman has a very great difficulty following the target and hitting the target. So that's the level. See, what it meant was if you had to go through the city at 30 miles an hour or at 15 miles an hour, then you take additional precautions. Well, they didn't even take the precautions that are required at 44 miles an hour, even though the president was moving at about 6 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And how this happened was that in the days before they went to Dallas, and you know they had been touring in Texas, calls were made to certain military units and to certain Secret Service units saying, you won't be needed in Dallas. Maybe they were using San Antonio, maybe they were using Houston. And to the military unit, they said, we don't need you in Dallas. Well, the assumption of that commander is that somebody else's military units, you know, there's a lot of these units, and he would be used. They never dreamed that it meant the city would have nobody. And as you know from the record, there was no Secret Service and no military men of this with this training in the Dealey Plaza area. Mm-hmm. The evidence of it is the photographs. One of the first things the Secret Service would do in a place like the Dealey Plaza area where high buildings look down over the road is they would close all the windows and seal them. Put a seal on it that says to anyone working in the building, do not open the window. Then they say, yes, but how are you going to control maybe hundreds of people? It's not hard. You put a man on the roof with a radio. You put another man down in the middle of the plaza on the grass looking up, and he's got a radio. If he sees a window open, he broadcasts immediately, third floor, fourth window over. And one of the team on the roof runs down there, sees why the window, some secretary opened a window to see the president go by, and you say, close that window, and it's closed. If it isn't, you stop the president's parade. You got a radio, you can do it. You yeah. see, it's not a big job. In fact, it's done every day. I went to Mexico City with the people that were sent to protect the president, President Eisenhower in Mexico City, and you'd think, my word, we can't get the president through here safely. But we do. There's no problem with it if you do the job.
Yeah.
What happened to the Secret Service was not that the Secret Service didn't do their job. They weren't asked to do the job. Yeah. They were told, your unit isn't needed. You can go home. And then they didn't tell anybody to do it. Very, very clever planning, because it would make it seem as though the Secret Service didn't do their job. Wasn't their fault, see? Or that the Army, I have talked to the Army commander involved, and he didn't know that there wasn't going to be the other Army unit there. He thought if his unit isn't needed, the other one will be there, see? And it's very hard for those people to, it's like if you go out in the woods with a hunting dog, and all of a sudden the dog sees a pheasant, he starts running, you say no. Well, the dog's trained to go for the, he wants to go for the pheasant. See, you have a hard job stopping him. This is his job. Well, this happened in Dallas in all of these things. Then added to this, there were false Secret Service there. Many, many witnesses who were on the ground in Dallas said something like, I was taking pictures and a man who showed me the credentials of Secret Service took my camera and removed the film. And he identified himself as Secret Service. Or others said that they met people there who identified themselves as police. In fact, there were pictures of policemen at the Dealey Plaza area, ostensibly Dallas policemen, but they're in stage uniforms. They're not in police uniforms. Their insignia don't match Dallas police. The shoes are different from Dallas police. They're carrying shotguns, something Dallas police don't carry, and so on. Who put those teams together? And who put them in Dallas at this time? What arrangements were made ahead of the president's murder that had all those people there before the president was even shot? You see, that's how you answer the problem of who killed the president, how he was killed, and why he was killed. What pressure groups were built up that would enable a team of hundreds of people to work on this? And I haven't even mentioned how other trained people, for instance, operated at the autopsy room so that when the doctors trying to save the life of the president wrote down that they saw the whole back of the president's head gone from the gunshot wound, that they operated on a cut in his throat that was an entry wound. Then by the time they had the autopsy in the Bethesda Naval Hospital, 8 or 10 hours later, they reported wounds of entry in different places. They had completely shifted the autopsy around. Who arranged all that? Who arranged that entire cover story? Mm-hmm. Mr. Zapruder, who took the film of this thing, just happened to be there with a movie camera. He happened to be taking pictures of the president's car as it went by. Somebody located him that night, and the Life magazine people paid him, I don't know, $50,000, some big amount of money for his film. Then when the Life magazine published extracts from his film, they reversed certain of the film slides to make it appear that the president's head went forward when it really went backward, and so on. Who set up that cover story? You see, the whole thing is shot through with cover stories. That shows an enormous power center behind the president. Certainly not Lee Harvey Oswald or Castro or the mafia or some other nebulous group. This was an inside, powerful group that scheduled all the events of this thing so that they would come together with not only the murder of the president, but the takeover of the U.S. government.
In some of the writings you've done, which are being compiled currently into a book called The Saigon Solution, about the CIA involvement in Indochina and, in effect, climaxing with the assassination of Kennedy, you write about aspects of this security being so lax in Dealey Plaza and no one being on the buildings and none of the windows being closed and all of the airtight procedures that they had developed as an agency, the Secret Service, since they had been formed in the 1903 or whatever after McKinley's assassination, and none of those things being followed that day, which then recently I was reading Jim Garrison's new book On the Trail of the Assassins, where he lays out evidence of the parade route map on the front page of the Dallas Morning News that morning, November 22nd, showing the parade going straight down Main Street, never indicating any turn onto Houston or then another turn onto Elm. And in that type of context, if the top-level Secret Service people were not even aware of this last-minute change, because as of that morning, they were still saying, no, the parade route is going straight down Main Street if you want to go along the route and have a good chance of seeing the president. What is your sense of how the Secret Service or who was somehow involved in this monumental setting up of the ambush site by rerouting a last-minute change in the parade route to accommodate this absolutely essential place to get the car to go slow enough to get a shot in?
That's a very important detail that Jim Garrison has pointed out, because the Secret Service, along with its military assistance, studies the route that the president will travel over in any city, not just Dallas, any city, for at least 90 days ahead of time. They study all the idiosyncrasies of that bit of the city, you know, where people could be hidden on a roof, what windows, what angle of fire they'd have from certain windows, what speed the car would be traveling at certain corners. And of course, they try to reduce corners. They try to go perfectly straight. And that's what the map in the paper showed, a straight route right through the city. Well, it is not Secret Service policy to change a route at the last minute. They've done too much work. If something comes up that causes them to want to change a route at the last minute, they're more apt to change the president's trip entirely, but not even have him stop there. Yeah. They will. They did that just before the trip to Dallas. It was either a trip to Chicago or a trip to Miami where they had some problem, and the public was told that President Kennedy was suffering from a severe cold and could not make the trip. Well, the Secret Service isn't going to put him in a position where he's doing something counter to their own best regulations. And they have very thorough regulations. They can keep the president alive. So the fact that the parade route was changed, and changed even after, apparently, after the Dallas News had been told what the route was, and after they printed a major map, what was it, about 5/6 of the front page. It was an enormous map on the front page of the paper. And then the route was changed in spite of that, is simply underscoring our evidence that elements within the structure of the government at a very high level were able to get such things as that route change, despite the fact they had told, for instance, the Dallas News very shortly before the parade that he was going to be on a certain route.
Right.
Now, the important thing there is that if the Dallas News knew that, the Dallas Police knew that, the Dallas Sheriff's Office knew that, the Secret Service knew that, the military people working on the deal knew that, everybody else knew that the route was one. And then all of a sudden, when he made this drastic change around the triangle there and the car slowed to 4 or 5 miles an hour, it was a shock to all of these people there. And yet, what is really amazing is you don't hear any of these people talking about that. And maybe hundreds of them were on duty that day and found that their jobs were totally ignored as the car went off on its own somewhere else. And yet, there's been no word from them. They've been covered up totally. You see, it works both ways. The place was left vacant of its normal guard, of its normal observation and all that sort of thing. And then the men that were there and saw this happen have been kept from speaking about that ever since. I don't know the witness of any man from the Secret Service or any other place that tries to explain why that change was made. They just leave it hanging in the air like that as though, well, it's something we can't account for. It's part of the crime, just like everything else. And Garrison is right to point that out.
Which there's other discrepancies as well in terms of seeing that somehow there must have been a lot of people who did sense a different parade route, because, of course, there was a great throng of people right at the corner of Houston and Elm. Zapruder was up on
the
pergola.
Well, but the streets were very close. It was a small triangle. And the fact, as you notice in some of the pictures taken, people who had been on Main Street were walking across the grass over to the other street. Really, it was not that kind of a problem from the viewer's point of view. What it was is it put the president at a very slow speed, making corners that he should not have been making, and right under the guns, and I say guns on purpose, that had been placed there to kill him. And it was absolute ambush, if ever I saw one, a real Wild West ambush.
There was, you showed me the AP photograph you had the other day of some of the tramps that were picked up, and there were no recorded arrests besides that of Lee Harvey Oswald that day, when, in fact, at least in this case, there was 4 or 5 photographs of 3 different people being led from the railroad yards through Dealey Plaza over to the police station, and yet no record ever of anyone else being arrested. But these people appeared to be being taken in, although, as you said, some of the officers in those photographs are wearing stage uniforms, the emblems don't match, etc. In one photograph particularly, there's a person who is walking away from the camera. It's the only person in the photograph you can't see the face of. And one of the tramps in the front that he's just passed sort of has a smirk on his face. Could you comment about your interpretation of who that is in that photograph?
Well, the photographic evidence as a total at that time is absolutely amazing. I believe it has been said that there's something between 5 or 6,000 pictures taken. That includes single slides from movie cameras and the rest. But what various researchers have done is take all these photographs and place them in a time frame so that you can see where people standing in one place and there's the same person over here and other ones, and begin to identify some of these people. So we've worked very hard on looking carefully at who is in these pictures. Well, there are several of them that are really outstanding. And one of the most amazing is this group of these three men who the news story said had been removed from a boxcar in a rail yard right in back of Dealey Plaza and were being led from that boxcar by police to the sheriff's office. And that's the end of it. The trail ends. They weren't booked. There's no record of them at all. Well, let's look at the pictures. The pictures do show three men that somebody have called tramps. Well, they're dressed in brand new clothes. They got new shoes on. They have new clothes on. They are not tramps. The police that are leading them, one in front and one in back, are in what we call stage costume police uniform, because they are not Dallas police costume, the police uniforms. Their insignia do not match. One of them has very clearly a hearing device in his ear. Their shotguns are not police shotguns. Police don't carry shotguns. And furthermore, the Dallas police don't lead prisoners into the sheriff's office. The police and the sheriff's office work together, but their jobs are entirely different. And in a sense, taking prisoners to the sheriff's office is the last place the police would take any prisoners. So all that part of it is very questionable. So when researchers had arrived at that point, one of them came to me one day and said, look, of all the pictures we've studied, this little episode of these men being marched right across the in front of the school book depository building where Oswald was supposed to have been, and across the street by Dealey Plaza where the president's car had just gone, into the sheriff's office, there's something wrong about these pictures. So we looked at them very carefully. And in the very first picture, in addition to the two policemen and the three tramps, as they're called, is another man. And he's walking in the other direction. But the thing about it is, so that his back is more or less to the, or his side and his back is more or less to the photographer rather than face forward. But there's something about it is, how is it possible that anyone at Dealey Plaza that day, and here these men are probably being marched across there 5 minutes after the president was killed. Everybody was running around. People were excited. Sirens were blowing. And here's this man in a business suit, just as casually walking along. He doesn't even turn. He's not looking at anybody, just walking past. And he happens to be standing by these men as they're being marched. The least he would be doing is looking at these prisoners or looking at the policemen. You know, anybody would, especially at that time. This man's looking at nobody. So we studied him a little while. And I looked at it, and this was, I must say, what would I say, 66, 67, somewhere back there. And I recognized immediately that that man is General Lansdale. Now, Lansdale is a very interesting figure in the Kennedy era. And I know Lansdale. I worked with him off and on from about 1952 to 1963. So he retired. Now, this is interesting. He retired from the Air Force on October 31st, 1963. Well, of course, the picture could have been 100 other people, and I could be wrong, but I know him very well. Then I looked at the tramps themselves, and there's this strange little eye catch between this man and the first tramp coming by. In other words, the first tramp, instead of being seriously concerned about the fact that he may be charged with the murder of the president, is smiling. And the second tramp has a sort of a quizzical little look, and you can tell that he has looked at this man walking by, and he has the same kind of approach, you know, as though he's just been reassured everything's all right. The third man happens to be in back from the camera's point of view, and you don't see him at all. But that little bit of expression is saying an awful lot at that moment. The police themselves have expressions that indicate more that as if they were saying to somebody, say, boss, am I doing all right? You know, that kind of thing. In other words, was Lansdale walking down right in front of the school book depository building to sort of reassure some people here, maybe his employees or somebody that's working for him? What's the significance of that? Well, of course, that happened to be my own interpretation. The men who had brought the pictures to me hadn't the slightest idea who it was. And I decided at that moment that what was needed next was a lot of research. So I got some very clear copies of those professional pictures. These pictures were taken by a professional news cameraman. I got a clear picture. And I started mailing the picture to acquaintances of mine and acquaintances of Lansdale who knew him without any of my thoughts. I simply would send the picture and say, "Can you tell me what this looks like to you?" This was taken shortly after the death of the president, and I wonder if this picture calls anything to mind to you. You'd be amazed to find that from senior people in the government, such as Lansdale was or such as I was at the time, I got immediate confirmation that's Ed Lansdale. Okay. Well, now, I don't know why he was in Dallas. I can't go into that. But it's astounding that this man, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations after General Graves Erskine retired, who was the man who had more or less almost single-handedly set up Diem as President of South Vietnam, who again almost single-handedly had set up President Magsaysay as the President of the Philippines, who was considered probably the most significant person in the U.S. military, U.S. government, on the subject of counterinsurgency, civic action, special forces, Green Beret troops. He had written the books that the Green Berets used in their courses down at Fort Bragg. What could have been his role at that time? I had a very personal interest in that because only a month or two before that, Lansdale had met me in the halls of the Pentagon and said that he had arranged for me to go as a military escort officer with a VIP party to the South Pole. Of course, I didn't mind going as a paid-by vacation to the South Pole, but it had nothing to do with my work I'd been doing for years in the Pentagon. There were no special reason why I should go. The work at the South Pole had nothing to do with special operations or covert activities. It was a perfectly above-board job. And it happened that I left for the South Pole on about November 10th or something like that, and that I was in New Zealand on the way back from the South Pole when I heard about President Kennedy being killed. Why Lansdale asked me to go to the South Pole, I have no idea. Or was there some connection between this role that he may have been playing in Dallas and the fact that he would just as soon I be out of town? And I reflected on that, especially when I begin to realize that almost all of Kennedy's cabinet was out of town, that some 45 officials with the cabinet were also out of town in Honolulu and on their way to Tokyo. They were actually on their way to Tokyo when the president was killed. And over the years, I have made a study of how many people central to the inner workings of the secret government of this country had been moved out of Washington at that time. It's a very, very interesting subject. I wish I could answer it. I don't know how to answer it. I'm sure the picture is Lansdale. Others are sure it's Lansdale, and I have to leave it there.
This experience you had in New Zealand is very interesting to me in terms of the influence and scope of the kinds of stories that were flooding out of, I guess it was British AP, as well as others, moments, or at least hours, immediately after the assassination. Why don't you talk more about how that, in retrospect, you got the newspaper at the time, and looking back on it, how it didn't seem to make sense.
This is an interesting aspect of the president's murder, and I'd like to know more about what was printed in overseas papers. But I was in New Zealand, specifically Christchurch, New Zealand, at the time the president was killed. And I was with a U.S. congressman. We were having breakfast. And of course, it's shocking news, but limited over the radio. They only announced that he had been killed, and he'd been killed in Dallas. And that's all we knew for several hours. Then the Christchurch newspaper, and of course, this was Saturday morning in Christchurch, New Zealand, the newspaper came out I would estimate some 3 hours, maybe 4 hours after the president's death. It was an extra. They were hawking it down the streets. And of course, I ran out and grabbed the first copy I could get, which I still have. I showed it to you the other day. Well, it's a very interesting thing because news that's printed immediately like that is more apt to come right from the record than to have been massaged a little bit the way the weekly magazines had it, or even some of our own newspapers where they had access to things, their own telephones and everything. And of course, I understand completely that world news today is in real time. There's no shortage of information. But the problem of researching and digging things out of files takes a certain amount of time. So this first paper on the street is really a most important statement of the way things were handled with respect to news immediately after or even before the president was killed. So we read the paper. There's a big picture of Kennedy in the paper, obviously, and a story about Kennedy and his 1,000 days in Washington and the significance of those things. The other half of the paper is devoted to what reporters right on the scene had sent out from there. And one report, either attributed to a reporter from Reuters or British AP, said that he heard automatic rifle fire. Now, these experienced reporters who have credentials to travel in presidential processions like that are highly qualified men. Many have been war reporters, and many have been in all kinds of events where they certainly know the difference between a single shot rifle going bing, bing, bing over 6 seconds, or automatic weapons fire, where they're going brrr like that and they know something happened. So that those few lines where the paper printed that the president was killed by a burst of automatic fire say quite a bit when later the Warren Commission tries to tell us that a lone gunman fired 3 separate shots over 6.8 seconds. That's the first thing we noticed. Then we read a little further down the column, and they began to talk about Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, remember at that time, Lee Harvey Oswald is a nondescript American ex-Marine, 23, 24 years old. And of course, police have files on people, and the newspapers have files. And with a little bit of research, they can put these things together, and you can expect you'd get some information. But what they print about Oswald is very elaborate, that he had gone to Russia, he had worked in Russia, he had defected to Russia, married a Russian wife, had come back and went to work in Dallas, had worked with a Fair Play for Cuba committee in New Orleans. And it's almost like a book written 5 years later. There's enough information about Oswald to fill pages. Furthermore, there's a picture of Oswald well-dressed in a business suit, whereas when he was picked up on the streets of Dallas after the president's death, he had on some
a t-shirt
or something, very, you know, just dressed shirt average with a polo shirt or something like on, but not a business suit with a necktie and all that. So of course I had no reason not to believe what I read in the paper. These things I've studied since then, but even so, you wonder now, where did the paper get that information so immediately and such complete information? But the headline was even more important. It said, "This is the man alleged to have shot the president." Well, now, the police in Dallas had picked up Oswald in a theater on the grounds that he may have been the killer of a Dallas policeman named Tippit. Not because of the president. And it was either midnight or 1 o'clock the next morning before the Dallas police had finally issued the
formal charge.
The charges against Oswald, long after the paper had been printed.
Right.
Well, who wrote the scenario? Who wrote that script? Who had packaged all that information and distributed it, I assume, all over the world? If it got to Christchurch, New Zealand, it must have been everywhere else. Who had handled all that type of information prior to the president's death?
Right.
See? So that even just this business of the news releases begins to tell you that a big organization big enough to have planted this information ahead of the president's death was involved in the murder of the president. We've talked about the Honolulu conference and that the cabinet members were there. The speeches some of those cabinet members were supposed to have made in Japan were actually printed in the American newspapers on the day they were supposed to have made the speeches, even though they never went to Japan. Now, that's not always too surprising because speeches are mailed out ahead of time. But it is surprising to think that with the intervening death of the president, that something wasn't done immediately to recall that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So much news was already written ahead of time to say that Oswald killed the president and that he did it with these three shots. And yet things like the statement of automatic weapon fire begin to nullify some of that, because that's the clash between the reporter on the spot or the man that just got this big release coming over the wires that said Oswald was the killer of the president. I suppose if somebody got newspapers from 100 different cities around the world, you'd be able even more to corroborate this, because the information fed to them was all prior work.
Right.
Somebody had decided Oswald was going to be the patsy. And that's what the newspapers say. And there's his picture right in the Christchurch, New Zealand paper, right along the same issue with the picture of President Kennedy.
And as it's so telling to me is that we looked at it on a couple of days ago when we were looking at this paper, and we decided that you said you got that paper by midday on Saturday your time, which would have been about 3 or 4 hours after about 4:30 in the afternoon or so on Friday, November 22nd, Central Daylight Time, which was at least 8 hours before Oswald was charged officially with the murder of the president.
You see, to put the times in prospect, he was killed in Dallas at about 12:30 in the afternoon. That corresponded to 7:30 in the morning in Christchurch, New Zealand. I got the paper before noon, which is, we'll say, 7:30 to noon, four and a half hours. Okay? Now, that would mean in Dallas about 4:30 in the afternoon. Well, Oswald hadn't even been charged by the police with the murder, with the shooting at the president, by 4:30 in the afternoon. How did the papers get the information to say that, you see? And then the rest of the things that are in the paper also are equally unfounded, that the paper was saying what the police were going to say some 8 hours later.
Yeah.
It had to have been a set-up job to put that information in the papers. And such a lot. I'm only quoting a few things. There were the articles that I'm talking about were on the front page. They also had follow-on in the back pages of the paper. It was just filled with stuff about Oswald that most people didn't know for days and days in the rest of the country.
And the significance that those stories were coming from British AP, whereas the story about the bursts of automatic gunfire were from a Dallas
directly
dateline.
From Dallas, yes.
So
yes.
There was a...
There's a intervening procedure there. But again, we understand that news can travel anywhere in the world in real time. That's not the problem. It's the content. How the content could have been put together immediately. If anybody wants to study this in a rather interesting parallel, try to read the newspapers immediately after the allegation that President Reagan was shot by Hinckley right in on the streets of Washington, and you'll see that it took hours and hours for information to fall out of the papers with regard to Hinckley and all that sort of thing, whereas the information that came out about Oswald was out right away in minutes. It just doesn't make sense.
This whole indication of much higher or more powerful forces at play to lay things like this down and have the planted stories ready to go before the actual events themselves transpired certainly does indicate some form or level of tremendously powerful influences or interests behind the scenes, powerful, in fact, mostly because of their invisibility, because it's so hard to pin them down, to point at any group or interest that could be a likely candidate for a lot of this type of organization, planning, and real-time releasing of false stories or whatever else to paint the stories that then became the truth.